Coming up, how shy are you? Wait till you hear the gutsy thing that today's guest did to deal with his shyness. Also, what does it feel like to hold up a big, pivotal check from an important customer? I'm going to ask today's guest about that $500,000 check that changed everything for him. Also, I want to talk about what other startup sites hate to mention, which is the depression that I think only people with big dreams seem to feel. All right, all that and so much more coming up. Three messages before we get started. First, do you need a single phone number that comes with multiple extensions so anyone who works at your company can be reached no matter where they are? Go to grasshopper.com. It's the virtual phone system that entrepreneurs love. Next, does anyone you know need a beautiful online store that actually increases sales but is easy to set up and manage? Send them to shopify.com, the platform that top online stores are running on right now. Finally, do you need a lawyer who actually understands the startup world that you and I live in? Go to walkercorporatelaw.com. I've known Scott Edward Walker for years, so tell him you're a friend of mine and he'll take good care of you. Here's the program. Hey there, Freedom Fighters. My name is Andrew Warner. I'm the founder of Mixergy.com, home of the ambitious upstart and home of about 750 entrepreneurs who've come here to tell you their stories, to tell you how they built their businesses and to inspire you to go out there and build your own business. And hopefully when you do, you'll do what today's guest is doing. Come back here and tell your story. How does a founder who nearly goes bankrupt end up building companies worth tens of millions of dollars? Fabrice Grinda founded multiple companies, which we'll talk about in this interview, including Zingy, a mobile ringtones, wallpapers, and games company that he launched in 2001 and sold to Sprint a few years later. He also launched OLX, which offers free online classifieds and auctions, which provides more local service on a global level than other sites. Fabrice, welcome.
Thank you.
Hey, that check. We'll get into the story of how you launched the business, how you suffered through it. Thanks for being open about that and how you turned things around. But can you talk about, do you remember that check? Do you remember holding it, feeling it?
It was a momentous event because we had been struggling. I mean, literally for like 2 years, I'd missed payroll over the course of 2 years, 27 times, not in a row, including for the last 4.5 months in a row. And it was very unclear whether or not we were going to make it. I mean, we were on the verge of business bankruptcy. I was on the verge of personal bankruptcy. I'd missed rent payment for 5 months. I was being evicted. But I knew we were selling, but it was completely unclear how much we were selling. And I had no clue what was coming. I knew a check was coming. And then the check arrives, and it's like $500,000. And it was like, oh my God, we're saved. I mean, we had like a celebratory party with the remaining 8 employees because we'd gone like 23 employees to 8 employees over the course of that 4 months because, you know, when you stop paying employees, they stop showing up for work. And but it was like, I knew then that we had made it and we were going to survive.
Unreal. And you told me that even when you sold the business for, how much did you sell it for?
$80 million on May 31st of 2004, actually to a, not to Sprint, but to a publicly traded Japanese company in the same category. Sprint happened to be our biggest customer.
And that check didn't even feel as important, or that sale didn't feel as important as that first one to Sprint that turned around everything.
Well, at that point, because we'd signed every carrier after Sprint, you know, AT&T, Nextel, Verizon, et cetera, we looked like we were on a path for success. And things felt good already. We knew to some extent that there was going to be a successful outcome regardless of when and how it took place. Whereas before then, that check from Sprint changed everything because until then it was absolutely unclear after 2 years of like sweat and tears and blood that we were actually even going to make it. We weren't even sure we had a viable business. And so that was much, much more important than the ultimate exit.
All right. I want to hear the whole process, how you got the idea, how you suffered through it, how you built it up and got that sale, what happened afterwards. And the sale, it all seemed to start somewhere around the time that you were working for McKinsey and you recognized as you were working there that it wasn't right for you. How'd you know that that wasn't right for you and maybe you need to go out and be an entrepreneur?
Well, the reality is I probably knew before going to McKinsey that McKinsey was not going to be where my personal destiny lay because I'd already started playing with computers when I was 10. I got my first PC. I was building a BBS in the 1980s. Then when I got to college, when I was 17, I moved from Paris and Nice, where I'm from, to New York, to Princeton. And I started building a computer company, exporting high-end computer equipment from the U.S. to Europe, which paid for college, et cetera.
You mean you were just buying computers from the U.S. and selling it to who in Europe?
Retail stores, actually.
Retail stores.
And because I realized there was a price arbitrage and a time arbitrage where things were being released in the U.S. much earlier at much lower prices than in Europe. So because across the street from my grandmother's in Nice, there was a great a computer store. It happened to be the biggest computer store in Nice, became friends with the owner. And I came here and started selling to him and a few of my other friends, because, you know, good computer geeks. We had friends in the computer community. I started selling to them, and that built a small business. And so, and I saw the internet being born in a sense. I saw Gopher and Mosaic and Netscape, and it already felt reasonably frothy. I mean, Yahoo, et cetera. And in 96, graduating, I guess, top of my class from Princeton in economics, I was considering my options. And I considered joining a startup or creating my own startup, but I was 21, extraordinarily shy and introverted and socially awkward. I never had experience managing anyone. And I'm like, you know, I may start a company, but it's most likely going to succeed. Why don't I go to essentially finishing school? The place where I'm going to learn to think more strategically, to work in more role in communication skills. So went to McKinsey and loved my time there. I mean, met the most interesting and people I'd ever met before, and they became my best friends.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but yeah. Can you explain again, why did you go to McKinsey even though you were so entrepreneurial that you were importing computers to Europe and selling them at local stores? Why would a guy with that kind of entrepreneurial creativity go and work for McKinsey?
Because I felt I lacked structure. I didn't have necessarily strategic thinking skills. I didn't have oral and written communication skills. So the crisp art of writing a 15-page PowerPoint with one idea per page, a sentence, a title of 7 or 8 words with an action verb in the present, where you communicate the ideas with the conclusions at the beginning. I mean, it's the very opposite of intellectual discourse in college, where you're writing these long, flowery essays over 20 pages with conclusions at the end. And so it felt like business finishing school would improve my ability to think strategically, analytically, to manage people, to work with teams.
Is it worth it?
So at that time, I thought that if I'd chosen one path, it might close down the other path irreversibly. And the reality is, I suspect all three paths are good. Quitting after college, going and creating my own company, whether I succeed or fail, I'm going to learn a lot. If I join a startup, I'm going to learn a lot. And going to McKinsey, I love the time there as well. So I suspect there is no wrong answer and there's no wrong path. But I actually really cherished my 2 years there and learned a lot and met the best friends of my life. But clearly, it was not where my destiny was going to lie. I knew I was going to be an entrepreneur even going to McKinsey. I thought I was going to miss the bubble. But lo and behold, it lasted longer than I suspected. And so in 98, after 2 years of McKinsey, I decided it was time for me to be an entrepreneur, that I'd learned what I needed to learn. And so the problem is, I'm a mathematician, economist, consultant, didn't have an ounce of creativity in my body. And so after looking for 6 months of IT ideas to create, to reintermediate, to disintermediate, decided, you know what, this is not working out. Let's look at, many other people in the world have copied ideas, improved them, adapted them. And if it works for all these people, it can work for me. And so what's interesting is the reality is, as people, we live stand on the shoulders of our forefathers. I mean, we don't reinvent calculus every time. And so when you think about it, Facebook was not the best social network. The first social network happened to be the best. Google is not the first search engine. It just happened to be the best, and so on and so forth. So I started looking for ideas that I could take from the U.S. to the rest of the world, and came up with 9 business selection criteria, looked at pretty much everything, Expedia, E-Trade, Netflix, Amazon, Yahoo.
And your idea was, you might bring one of these guys to Europe, maybe be the E-Trade of Europe, maybe be
exactly.
The Amazon of Europe, okay?
And I chose to be the eBay of Europe. So
okay.
I sold my apartment, I quit McKinsey, in 96 I'd had the foresight to buy $50,000 worth of shares in Amazon, Yahoo, Intel, and Microsoft, so I sold all that. And that was the seed money for my first company, which was called Auckland, which was in eBay for Europe. And that, I mean, it was the beginning was hard again, but it was the bubble, so people were throwing money at people with my resume. So raised like 60 million in venture money, raised, you know, I had 150 employees in 5 countries, we're doing like 10 million a month in volume. But at the end of the day, the bubble burst, didn't really end up making any money from the transaction, sold the company to my majority shareholder, and started looking for what to do next. And so,
I'm sorry, let me pause right there. I just want to make sure that I understand this, because there were a lot of numbers flying there. You raised how much money?
$63 million.
$63 million. And then you said that there were millions of dollars coming in. How did you do millions of dollars in business in such a short period of time, back when there was hardly anyone online?
Well, the auctions was one of the first categories to grow in the internet, alongside online travel, e-trade, and e-commerce a la Amazon. And we duplicated exactly the eBay org chart. So we had like sales teams organized by categories with category managers. So we had coins and wine and stamps, etc. And we actually created really fun TV ads, which won prizes of like the Silver Lion in Cannes, etc. And these brought a huge, relatively huge audience. By today's comparison, when I look at the numbers of OLX today, which is my current site, and the numbers of Auckland 12 years ago, it's shocking how small those numbers were, but they seemed huge at the time. And it worked reasonably well. I mean, it was the early days, but there's an early adopter audience, which allows you to do enough volume to have a real business. I mean, Amazon was already doing hundreds of millions of revenues. It's just not the tens of billions that they're doing today, but there was a business there. And so the company did rather well. And then I sold it in late 2000 to my majority shareholder and started looking for what to do next. And in the process, I met a bunch of Europeans selling mobile content. And the first time I met them, you know, the guy was telling me he's going to sell ringtones for like $2. I'm like, this is crazy. No one's ever going to pay for them. It's never going to work. It's silly. And of course, 6 months later, the guy's doing $2 million a month in revenues, profitable, growing like gangbusters. And so I admitted that I was wrong, and I had been wrong about the idea. Also decided not to judge ideas, but actually look at them more objectively. And started looking at the U.S. market. And at that time, the U.S. market was in the dark ages of mobile. I mean, we didn't have text messaging within carriers, let alone cross carriers. You needed to buy a $5 text messaging plan. There was no SMS billing or premium SMS. There was no carrier billing. And the people that should have been doing this, there's people, UPOC doing mobile messaging, et cetera.
People who should have been doing this.
There were companies that were ideally located or positioned in the market to go after this opportunity. They didn't believe in it.
I see.
And they had raised tons of money, et cetera. So I'm like, you know what? This is an idea that I know how to execute. It doesn't require much capital, which is good, given that now capital is no longer available post-bubble. And so I decided to do a reverse arbitrage and bring a European and Asian idea to the U.S. market. So moved back to the U.S. on July 2, 2001 and started building Zingy.
I see. How did – what is it called? It was called Jamba?
Jamba, J-A-M-B-A, yes. That was the inspiration, actually. One of the two inspirations for Zingy.
I see. So they were one of the two companies that you were watching develop, and you said, I've got to do that.
Exactly.
How do you even launch something like this? This isn't the kind of company that you can launch on your own, right? What do you do?
You need a number of things. You need the contents and the content licenses. And so I started doing an analysis of who owned the various rights. At that time, we were reproducing music, and music has three layers of rights. The performance rights, which you get from two companies, VMI and ASCAP, which allow you to play the music publicly. Mm-hmm. The mechanical rights, which is the right to the underlying underlying music, which you get from publishing houses. And then the master license, which you get from the labels on the voice. At that time, the phones didn't support voice, so it was all about getting the publishing rights and the performance rights. And in the U.S., there's no database of where to get those. And so we started building literally detective work to figure out who wrote which song and who they were represented by, to start clearing the rights one by one. And at the same time, we started talking to the carriers, and they didn't want to deal with us. So we actually hacked into the carrier delivery networks so we could start delivering our content. They said, of course, it was not doable, impossible, you cannot deliver there. But we found a way to deliver the content to carriers. And there was no billing system, so we started charging by credit card.
What do you mean you found a way to hack into their system so that people can get ringtones?
If you actually sent to a phone number the data in a certain encrypted way, it could actually turn into a ringtone or a logo, et cetera. And so we found ways to send messages to on the AT&T and at the time VoiceStream, now T-Mobile networks, to do that and little found ways to deliver content, even though the carriers didn't support it, didn't even care about it in a way. And they didn't have SMS gateways the way they were built
later.
How'd
you find someone who could do that?
Hired a great CTO who had been in the he'd been working in the mobile and industry for like 10 or 15 years. And we had a conversation. I realized he was fantastic and brought him over from New York, from wherever he was. I think he was in Canada, to New York, and we started working. And so, and on the right side, by the way, at first, none of the publishers wanted to give us any of the rights. I mean, they were like, you're a tiny startup. You're not willing to pay. I mean, we're willing to pay per download, but we didn't have money to pay for advances. And so when they refused to give us the rights, I started, I'll admit, we violated pretty much a lot of the copyrights in the sense that we had documented who owned them, and we had not actually cleared them because they didn't want to give us a license. And so I started keeping a track of all of them and sending them checks. Some of them were stupid enough to actually deposit my checks, in which case we had almost an implicit agreement. And some of them, they didn't cash the checks, but then I would get like these – I got hundreds of cease and desist letters, and it's $250,000 infringement or fee per infringement. So they were asking for tens of millions. The good news is you can't shave an egg. I had nothing. I had no money in the company. I had no personal money. There's nothing they could take. So when these really nasty lawyers would call me, it's like I would reply. It's like, oh my god, this is fantastic of you to reach out to me. I've been trying to talk to you forever, you know. And so just by being extraordinarily friendly, they were somewhat taken aback. But I told them, look, I want to pay fees. I want to clear the license of music. I want to pay you. I can't obviously pay tens of millions of infringement fees, but I'm more than happy to make good and pay for all the downloads. And so ultimately, by starting that dialogue, and when they realized that if they sued me, it would cost them more than whatever they could get from me, they decided to give me licenses. And so,
and forgive all the debt that supposedly you were building up when you were using it without their permission.
Exactly.
I see.
And so I paid up all the things that we owed them, and we were the only ones to get licenses. And so when carriers, 2 years in, so it took 2 years to get the first carrier contract, just showing, knocking their doors. They don't want to sign little companies because they think we're not going to be around. But going to CTIA, going to all the events, knocking their doors, showing that we were resilient. Eventually, I convinced one of them, Sprint, to give us a shot. And they decided that let's give a try to these ringtone things. They only licensed 25 of them from us. And these 25s, which were the top hip-hop songs, which were the only ones that have cleared, are the ones that actually led to the $500,000 check.
So you're knocking on doors while you're using this music that you don't have a license to. Are the carriers asking you about these licenses the way that I just asked?
Well, we only gave the licensed music to the carriers, obviously. We didn't want to take risks. So, of course, we were indemnifying them for any copyright infringement, given that we were the ones providing the content. But because we had gotten the licenses before we actually signed the carriers, when we gave the content to the carriers, we were already cleared and we were all good to go.
So then how did you get those cease and desist letters and so many of them if you weren't yet on people's phones?
Oh, because we were selling directly on Zingy.com from the website to the consumers. And so we were already visible. And then we signed a deal with MSN or with Microsoft, and we started selling it on the MSN portal as well. And so the combination of those two things, you know, meant that we were somewhat visible. Plus, some of the labels like Loud Records with Wu-Tang Clan did promotions with us. And so we became reasonably visible in that industry. I mean, we were on MTV News a few times, et cetera. And so by virtue of being visible, we started getting sued.
I see. Okay. So at first you were going direct to consumer. Was that your plan all along, to stick with consumer and then you adjusted?
It was the plan to go to B2C, which was actually the way it worked in Europe and in Asia. But in the US, the carriers were not open enough. There was no billing method, et cetera. And so ultimately we had to pivot. I mean, we'd stay in the same category, but instead of being B2C, it became B2B2C. And actually it was a better strategy for us because the B2C approach would have required a lot more money. I mean, capital was not available in 2001 after the bubble burst, and eToys and Pest.com and Webvan and all these guys have gone under, plus all the telecom companies have gone under. Venture capital to do was not available.
I see, right. And so if you're going to go B2B, I mean B2C, meaning business to consumer, you have to buy all these ads to get each customer one at a time versus going business to business, which is partnering with the carriers, and they could bring thousands potentially millions of customers your way.
Exactly. They did the marketing. We did the back end.
When you're dealing directly with consumers, what happens when the consumer doesn't have a phone that you support?
We would make them select a phone before we sent the content. So they didn't have a phone or carrier we supported. We just didn't deliver. And we told them and we didn't bill them.
How profitable or how successful was it when you're just going direct to consumer?
It was small. I mean, in 2001, we did maybe a couple hundred thousand in sales. In 2002, we did a million in sales. I mean, we were minuscule, and it was not profitable because we had very expensive billing costs. It was just a disastrously small operation, but it set the stage for the B2B to C play, because once we had the license, is recognized as one of the leaders in the industry. And once the carriers finally decided this was an industry or category they cared about, we were one of the few choices they could come to. And so even though it wasn't an interesting business in its own right, it actually set the stage for future success.
You said that there were so many times that you missed payroll. Do you remember one of the first times that you had that big a setback that you couldn't afford to pay your own employees?
It's probably in 2002, because I'd been trying to raise money, but no one wanted to invest. And so I ultimately ended up raising $1.4 million, but we raised it like $10,000 at a time. It was like $10,000 there, $20,000 there, et cetera. And so the first time I didn't have any personal money and we missed payroll, I just told the employees, something went wrong with the payroll processor. I don't know why they didn't process payroll. It'll come in a few weeks or whatever.
You told them the kind of thing that people say to their landlord in the ghetto. What, I sent you the check or you didn't see it?
Okay. Exactly. It's on the way. I'm not sure what happened. And it happened repeatedly to the point that they started believing the bank was just incompetent, as opposed to the fact that I had no money to pay them.
By the way, 10,000 at a time, 10,000 here, 10,000 there. How are you getting so many checks that you end up with over $1 million? Where are they coming from? Who are these
people? You beg and grovel every single friend you have, every friend of friend you have, every family member you have, and I'm lucky enough to have a very big family. And so, I mean, and a few people wrote us $50,000 check, et cetera. And then one of my friends created a little funny. He actually wrote a $500,000 check. So it became that helped a lot. But
what kind of friend did you have at the time who had $500,000 to invest?
He had been the founder. He had his own .com bubble story. His name is Stefan Paterner. He had created the Globe.com. And his father was reasonably well off, and he created a little fund. So he didn't have personally $500,000 to invest, but he had a number of people around him that were wealthy enough, and they were willing to back me. And I'm very grateful for the opportunity to have been backed by them.
So if you and I had known each other back then and were friends on Skype the way we are now, you might have just Skyped me and said, "Hey, Andrew, you got a moment?" How would you have sold
absolutely.
Me? Just like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Whatever it takes. I mean, and that's what it took to get the carrier contracts. And the reason we got them, no one else, is whatever they wanted us to do, we said yes to. We agreed to build whatever they wanted under whatever specs, et cetera. Same thing with licenses. Being scrappier, working harder than anyone else was our key to success.
Can you give me an example? Like, what was your sales tactic when you're trying to get investors at a time when no one was investing, where it felt like anything digital was just a fool's errand?
Well, the good news is there were good secular trends. I mean, cell phone penetration was exploding. This business was ready to become a billion-dollar business both in Europe and Asia. And so I was selling a vision of it being even bigger than that here in the future. And therefore, the category was worth investing in. And it made sense to be an early player. And I was the right guy to do it. And so a combination of relevant past experience plus selling the billion-dollar vision worked, because there were actually comparables that had worked in the rest of the world.
All right. So you raise some money. You're constantly saying yes to everything that the carrier says. Eventually, they say yes to you. But when you're saying yes to everything that a customer wants, aren't you in a way, I don't know how to say it, but aren't you taking on too much? Aren't you losing focus of what your project is? Aren't you creating a mess?
Well, to some extent, yes, but I didn't say we delivered on everything we promised. We said yes to whatever they wanted to get the contract. Once we were in contract and they were already, you know, half pregnant, you can't really you can't stop pregnancy. And so when they set completely unrealistic deadlines, et cetera, we said, look, we'll meet the deadline, but of the 170 things you asked us to do, let's do the 10 most important.
And start with that.
And start with that. And then
what's
and little
something
by little
that they
by
asked you to do that there was just, you knew going in, you couldn't do it. It didn't make sense, but you'll deal with it after the contract.
You know, I can't even remember, but there were a lot of inane things. I mean, from supporting really legacy handsets to some elements of their billing system that were just too complex, to the way they wanted to present the product that was maybe not what we had already built by default, it required a lot of extra development. And so we just said, look, we'll deal with it later. We'll build it later. And ultimately, they accepted it because they were already half pregnant. And so we saw, and they had to launch, and they had agreed to launch internally. And so as long as we had people that were the project and product managers internally in the carriers on our team, we were okay. And so I made sure that they were happy and they were perceived to be well. And then the numbers got so big when we went live that these guys became heroes in the companies and all got promoted. And so the fact that we had missed on 99% of the deadlines that they asked us to set didn't matter.
You know, as you and I are talking, you're happy, you're in a confident place, life is good, smiling. Take me to the lowest point during this time, because it couldn't have been this easy where every trouble just, you know, was felt surmountable, where you were coming up with clever solutions and didn't worry about things. Take me to that lowest point. Let me identify with that a little bit.
So the lowest point was probably prior to launching the company. So in the prior life, when I was running the eBay of France and Southern Europe, I'd been on the cover of every magazine. It'd been a huge success. I'd been regarded as like the internet entrepreneur of France and like bringing the internet to France, et cetera. And when, so having had reached such a high summit, if you want, once I sold the company for peanuts, I was really down because it felt as though I'd let slip through my hands the biggest opportunity of my life. It's very rare in life that you're at the right time, at the right place, with the right skills, and for whatever reason, the stars had aligned. What had been my hobby, computers, became a very large industry and I had the right skills to capitalize on it. And so the bubble passed me through, and I didn't capitalize on it. I let that opportunity go by me, and as I pondered what the future held, all the options seemed depressing. I mean, I didn't want to go back to McKinsey. I didn't want to be a consultant. I didn't want to go to business school. You know, it's a reasonably okay way to rebound from an opportunity, but I'd given speeches to business schools. There were case studies on what I'd done in business school, and I felt I'd learned more in that experience of hiring, firing, raising the money, et cetera, that I would ever possibly learn. And so as I pondered my options, I decided ultimately, you know, and it took me a while, and I wrote myself a long-winded, depressed email in the middle of the night, weighing what I should be doing, and decided, you know what, at the end of the day, I didn't become an entrepreneur to be successful. I became an entrepreneur because I like entrepreneurship. I like creating something out of nothing. I like building products, and I like having customers and customer base that is happy. And even though I probably let that single best opportunity of my life to succeed early go slip by, it made sense for me to continue in that path because that's what I'm built for.
What was that depressing email that you sent yourself?
It's on my blog, actually. I think it's called something about the value of introspection. And I've actually used that trick every few months. I take a step back and evaluate where I am in my personal and business life to make sure that I can tell the forest from the trees. And make sure that I'm at least directionally happy and going in the right direction.
And this is on FabriceGrinda.com, right?
Correct.
But that's before. That's when you're on your own, when there aren't employees looking to you to cheer them up, when there aren't business partners who are looking for you to get paid, when there aren't customers who are sometimes screaming at you and employees who are feeling betrayed by you and carriers that are letting you down by being so stodgy. And you've got every penny and every ounce of yourself invested in this business. That's what happened when you were running a business. Talk to me about that. How, when you were at Zynga, what was that low like?
You know, the problem is, even though I realized how close we were to failing, I just didn't have time to ponder it because you have to be the number one cheerleader for the company. And so regardless of how much anguish I felt internally, I need to be presenting the sunshine, smiley face to the outside of the world, be it the customers, the clients, or the press, or the potential investors, or the employees. And so it was all keeping the facade. And eventually, I think if you keep saying positive things all day long to everyone, you start feeling a bit more positive, even though you know there you have internal doubt. But it didn't necessarily materialize or it was not expressed in any way, shape, or form in the sense that I didn't really actually have time to really ponder whether or not
because
we're going to make it.
Because you spent so much time pumping everyone up with this vision, you kept yourself from feeling any low. Don't we all have highs and lows?
Yeah, absolutely. I felt lows, but it wasn't as much anguish as like when you're left alone in the future. And that's why the intermission between the first company and Zingy was actually a lower low, because I had much more time to think about it. Whereas
you know
when you're
help
busy.
Me think this through, because sometimes I've had moments in my life as an entrepreneur where things weren't working. And I would pump everyone up with how it was going to work, with the good things that were working. And there was a part of myself that still said, you're a fraud. How can you possibly think that you're someone who speaks the truth, who can be counted on, when you're saying that everything's going to be okay, even when you know that, you know, there's a good chance they won't be? How do you deal with that?
I think all entrepreneurs need to have a reality distortion field, because if you can't convince people that you're going to change the odds, you're not going to succeed. The reality is the five-year survival rate of a startup is around 5%. So 95% of companies that are started are going to fail. And you need to personally believe that you are so extraordinarily good, that you have such clarity of purpose and vision, that those odds do not apply to you, and that maybe they're closer to 50-50, or maybe even in your favor, because you know what you're doing. And as long as you really have that belief, yes, are we potentially deluding ourselves and others? Absolutely. But it's okay, because the alternative is worse.
So whenever you're in your mind saying, wait a minute, I just deluded myself, and as a result, I pumped up somebody else with something that may not be, you know, the full picture, go, yes, you did delude yourself. Congratulations, you're a real entrepreneur now.
Exactly. And by the way, it's also what's making it happen. I mean, if we actually, I think in that case, full transparency and honesty is more likely to depress people and actually to lead to the negative outcome. Through sheer work and focus, you can actually change the probabilities. You can't necessarily completely move them in your favor, but I think you can nudge them in the right direction.
All right. You kept growing this business. Then you got that check that we talked about at the top of the interview from Sprint. About $500,000. You hold it up. I don't know why, by the way, you didn't make a copy of it and frame it. We talked.
Yeah, me neither. But I was in a hurry to deposit it. Like, we need this.
I recently got checks of all the $500,000 and above, copies of all the $500,000 and above mm-hmm. checks that we had, which I copied and scanned years ago, and I lost track of. A friend of mine had them all. It was so beautiful to look at.
But you know what's funny? It's like we grew so fast. So we did $5 million in sales in 2003. 50 in 2004, 200 million in 2005. And so like in 2005, like I think in 1 month in January 2006 after I left, I mean, we got like 36 million in a month. And so it's the numbers got so big that like $500,000, as important and essential as it was, it became so de minimis. I mean, all of a sudden we were selling hundreds of thousands of dollars a day.
Wow.
And so
because of the partnerships with the carriers.
Because of the partnerships
with
the carriers.
It's tough to get them, but once you get them, it just skyrockets you.
Well, that was true then. I'm not. It's less true in a smartphone world today, right, where your dependency is more on Apple and Google. But at that time, it was the key to this region.
You show the check to your number two employee and the number three employee who'd been with you through the highs and lows, and they say what?
And unfortunately, they had just taken the decision to quit before, and it just so happened that their last day was the day the check arrived. And I went to them and like, guys, this is it. We are saved. I mean, the future now is rosy. We're in a path of prosperity. But they were both in their 40s, both married with kids, mortgages, kids going to college or about to go to college, and they couldn't deal with the highs and the lows and the missed payroll anymore. And I tried my best to convince them to say, and I think they felt that they'd heard that story one too many mm-hmm. times, and so they left that day. Which I mean, frankly, to their detriment, because when we sold for $80 million 9 months later, they actually left millions on the table because they didn't vest all their shares. They left before they were fully vested.
And you were at your low, how much money on your credit cards to build up this business?
Oh, negative $100,000. So I owed my, I hadn't paid rent in 5 months, and I was $100,000 in debt on my credit cards.
After you sold the business, how much did you personally get from that 80 million?
About half. So, I mean, 40 million, but pre-tax. So post-tax, I don't know, 27 million or something like that.
Okay. And when you're at that high, having gone through the low, when, by the way, can I tell you the one thing that causes me trouble with my interviewees? After the interview, they say, Andrew, please edit out the amount of money that I said, or edit out how I said that I did this thing with the contract. You just said both. You told me the amount that you got, and you told me about the contracts and how you told me about the deals with the, excuse me, told me how you got around not having agreements with the with for your music. Are you going to ask me to edit this? Is this going to hurt our relationship when I tell you I can't edit?
No, not at all.
Okay.
I believe in transparency, and at the that's why pretty much everything I do is documented in public on my blog and interviews, et cetera. And I think people need to realize for first how hard it is and what you have to do to succeed. And sometimes you cut corners, and that's why the little companies have a tendency to win over the big companies, because they're not willing to take risks. And ultimately, those risks actually paid off for everyone, from the
Yeah.
music companies to the carriers and so on. In terms of how successful people are, I think, look, money is just a measure of, it's a yardstick to see what you've done. And I don't know, it doesn't mean anything whether you've made 27 million or 100 million or 2
It
million.
doesn't mean anything. Like, don't you see some connection to your, not in a good level, not in a way that your
Yeah.
therapist would approve of, but don't you see in some level that you connect your personal self-worth with your net worth? Do you ever do that?
Hell no.
You
No,
don't, you never
absolutely
do
not.
that?
I mean, look, there's one thing that wealth does provide is freedom. And it's a freedom to choose to do the projects I want to do, the ability and to invest in other entrepreneurs and to see their ideas and push them forward. And clearly the ability not to need to worry anymore about making rent or paying employees if I want to make them, et cetera. So that peace of mind is actually invaluable. But I don't think it takes all that much money to start having it. Beyond that, no, my self-worth is more driven by whether or not I feel I'm building a great company, whether my customers love it, et cetera. So, for instance, I much prefer my current company, OLX, to Zingy, just because OLX, being a big classified site like Craigslist for the rest of the world, we have 150 million users every month. And I mean, we're like the 20th largest site in the world. And we get love letters from these users telling us how we've transformed their lives for the better. I mean, a woman would send us a letter saying that she fell in love with her husband all over again because she was able to find a babysitter that allows her to go on dates with her husband.
That's
Or
amazing.
someone who needed to find money sold her couch and she made rent. I mean, and we get these stories all the time. And so I feel pretty darn good about myself because our 150 million users really love the service we're providing to them for free. And in a way, it's more valuable than providing social currency to teenagers through selling them ringtones. And at the same time, it's a category and an industry I much prefer. Likewise, I mean, I've changed the lives of a number of my employees in Zingy who've become wealthy and successful. And I've also inspired many of those employees to become entrepreneurs. And same thing in OLX, we have 270 employees. A number of whose life has been changed, but also in general, they like to be in dynamic, fast-moving environment where there is flat hierarchies, and they can really contribute to making a difference in the lives of many. And last but not least, inspiring other entrepreneurs. And so the and to do all that, I think requires transparency. And but my net worth is not driven or correlated with my happiness. I
Is that
mean, I lost.
because you were raised outside the US?
Not so sure. I mean, I'm probably the most American Frenchman you're ever going to find. I mean, I speak English without an American accent. I love this country, and I'm the one of the most ardent proponents of capitalism there is. And so, I'm not nearly as sure as you on that one. It's just that, and at the end of the day, as humans, we want to maximize our utility, which is more happiness than I think net worth.
All right, I've got so much that I want to cover here. I want to cover OLX. I've got stories of the entrepreneurs you invested in, your sought after entrepreneur, excuse me, sought after angel investor who's done a ton of investments that I want to talk to you about. But let's just talk about why you sold Zingy first, and then we'll move on to OLX. Why sell the business when it's doing so well?
So Zingy violated one of my 9 business selection criteria. And that business selection criteria is never to be in a business where you have a risk of disintermediation and or margin compression by your suppliers and or your customers. And Zingy had both. We had massive revenue concentration. So at first, there were 10 carriers that accounted for all the revenues, but these carriers all merged with each other. I mean, Verizon bought Altel and T-Mobile, VoiceStream, and Singular AT&T, and all of a sudden, Sprint, Nextel, and all of a sudden, three carriers accounted for 95% of the revenues. And as soon as we started becoming big, meaning as soon as we hit $50 million in sales, they started squeezing us, renegotiating the contract, et cetera. And we were, as a supplier, I felt we were in a, we had a weak negotiating hand, and our margins were going to be compressed, or we were going to be disputed. At the same time, the labels and the publishers all merged with each other, and we went and we ended up with four major labels representing 40% of our costs, and the technology was shifting under our feet. The phones were becoming more capable. All of a sudden, you needed the full license, including the master license, or the music companies and the artists started realizing there was money in here and started asking for more money. And so I felt that the margin structure was going to move in a negative direction, which is something I'd anticipated, by the way. I knew at creating the company that it violated one of my 9 business selection criteria, but it was one of the few that I could do with no capital, and which was a requirement in 2001. And so despite my worries, I did it. And so I sold, and I sold too early. I mean, I sold when we only had done $4 million in revenues and $1 million EBITDA in Q1 04. And I never thought we were going to do $50 million in sales in 04 and $200 million in 05. But as I'd learned during the bubble before, better too early than too late. And so ultimately, I sold because I didn't love the business. I violated one of my 9 business selection criteria. And the opportunity to have that type of cash was actually life-changing. I felt that peace of mind and freedom and opportunity to do whatever I wanted in the future was worth it. And I had not taken advantage of it in the bubble. I turned down all the offers that had kept coming for Zingy in late 03, early 04, until an offer came that was just too big to say no to. And then I hired bankers, ran a process, doubled the price, and sold.
All right. And then the next business – and you stayed with the business. You helped grow sales. I think you had an earnout, if I remember right.
I had an earnout, but we obviously exceeded all the metrics. We blew through the numbers, and I stayed for 18 more months, partly because it was fun. I mean, I'd never been a part of a publicly traded company before. I'd been in a very high growth environment, not revenue growth to that extent. We moved offices like 6 times in a year. It was absolutely amazing. Now, the reason ultimately I left is I actually didn't like the people I sold it to. They didn't speak English at all. They didn't understand anything. They didn't want me to keep investing in the business. We had the opportunity to buy Shazam in the U.S., for $1 million, and they said no. I wanted to buy a lot of our competitors, move into mobile TV, start thinking through more advanced applications, and they just didn't want to invest in the business. And so it stopped being fun, and so started thinking through what to do next, and left on November 05, actually knowing what I was going to do next.
How'd you know that OLX would be the next thing?
Well, I started thinking through different opportunities, and there were 3 that came to my mind. I was thinking of doing Vente Privée, which is a private sales site in France, like selling billions for the U.S., so Gilt, basically, before Gilt was created. Mm-hmm. I considered doing Facebook for the rest of the world. Very happy I didn't choose that because we would have been obliterated by Facebook. And I started looking at Craigslist and realized that the world was moving from paid print classifieds to paid vertical sites like Monster or Hot Jobs to free horizontal classified sites, and that transition was already well underway in the U.S. and actually to some extent in Western Europe, but it was not underway in many other countries in the rest of the world, and it was only small local players with no real capital or technology that were going for it. And it was worth a shot, and obviously, the economist in me loves creating liquidity or creating marketplaces, like bringing liquidity to markets that are otherwise illiquid because they're too high transaction barriers made a lot of sense. So if you're in Buenos Aires, to put an ad in a newspaper, it's $100, which is a lot of money in a developing country. And so, of course, you're going to do it for a car or real estate or a job, but you're not going to do it to find a nanny. You're not going to do it to find a roommate. And so I felt there was a unique opportunity to create this free global marketplace going after all the countries that Craigslist was just neglecting because he didn't care. And he didn't want to improve it. I mean, Craigslist should have been, or like should not exist. So Craigslist should have been doing it. They should have been improving the product. They should have been going global. But Jim and Craig, I love what they've done with Craigslist, and I love the public service they provided the community, actually had chosen not to go after this opportunity. And I felt, you know what? let's go for it. Let's build Craigslist 2.0 or 3.0 and deploy globally.
And what was the business model that you imagined that you would have for OLX, and how did it shape out?
We actually followed the same business model that we intended to do. So many of the classified sites at that time were charging listing fees where you pay $50 or $100 for an ad. And we felt that was really Web 1.0 in the sense that it limited, as soon as you start charging, you start limiting your inventory. And we wanted exhaustivity. We wanted everyone to post in every possible category and not limit availability of content, whatever it may be. And so we chose to be on an advertising supported business model. So just Google Ads. If you're coming to OLX, you're looking for something. So if you search for BMW 325i Red in Union Square, Google is going to serve an ad related to that from a local car dealer, and it's going to be relevant. And so because you come with intent, we have a 2 to 3% click-through rate on ads. And because it's in high-value categories like vehicles, real estate, jobs, merchandise sales, and services, there are high CPCs. And so that combination of high CTR times high CPC leads to high CPM. And so it's a valid business model. And then on top of that, we sell our own self-service featured listings, and we have a few other business models, but we're never going to charge listing fees.
That makes sense. You told our producer, Jeremy, that one of the first things you did when you had the idea for OLX was you went to Argentina for a month. Why Argentina, of all places?
So in a prior life, I'd inspired a number of entrepreneurs from Latin America to build an eBay for Latin America, which was called Deremate, and was later sold to another eBay of Latin America called Mercado Libre, which is public on NASDAQ and called Meli. And it was a friend of mine from McKinsey and introduced me to that team of 13 people, and I gave them the business plan and the technology to go and do Deremate. And they sold that company to Mercado Libre in late 2005. So all of a sudden, this team of really smart people that I knew and respected were completely available. They understood auctions, and the reality is auctions and classifieds are not too dissimilar. They're both marketplaces where you need a critical mass of buyers and sellers in various categories. And if anything, classifieds is easier than auctions. And so I decided the CEO of Deremate, Alec Oxenford, and we became co-founders and co-CEOs of OLX. And we also hired pretty much the entire tech team and early team of Deremate, and they became the core founders of OLX. Now, originally, I would have rather built the company in the U.S., but we've had such difficulty retaining engineers because the U.S., unfortunately, with this idiotic immigration policy, forced us to actually lose most of our engineers. We had 85 engineers in New York with Zingy, and I had 120 people total, but half of them were from India and China. And when the H-1B allotments went from almost 300,000 to like 30,000, even when people needed to renew their H-1Bs, they went back in the lottery, and a lot of them just didn't get it. And so we had these amazing engineers that we trained that we were paying hundreds of thousands a year, at least 100,000 plus a year. We had to send them back home. And it was so annoying and it's so difficult to recruit that we decided, you know what, it's much easier. We already have a pool of 20, 30, 40 engineers. And by the way, there's no real competition for talent down there. Let's go and build our development center. And so we didn't outsource, we actually insourced. I mean, these were all people we hired and became employees in Argentina. And so today, of the 270 employees of OLX, 200 are in Argentina and Buenos Aires.
Can you talk a little bit about the chicken and egg problem that a business like this has? You want to get enough advertisers so that you have a lot of listings that will draw people, but you can't draw people unless you have a lot of advertisers, a lot of people who are posting listings.
So you start by figuring out who tends to gain the most from the marketplace. And clearly there's a short tail of sellers who tend to gain a lot in highly valuable categories like real estate, jobs, and cars. And these are people that in the past have been paying hundreds of dollars per posting to newspapers, et cetera. And so we basically built a sales team in Argentina with natives from all the various countries, so French natives, American natives, Indian natives, et cetera, to go and reach out to all the top advertisers in the various newspapers around the world, the top advertisers on the various job, car, and real estate and job sites around the world, and convince them to listen to OLX. And we told them, look, we have no traffic. We're completely honest and transparent here, but we're free, so it doesn't cost you anything. And who knows, it might work. And we're going to make it so easy for you. Whatever feed you have and whatever format you have it, so if you have your feed for Trulia, we'll just take it exactly in the same format. You don't even need to change a comma. And we'll do all the work to adapt. And so by being so easy and willing to work with anyone, we were able to we were able to convince a number of sellers to give us a lot of content. And so we had a critical mass in a number of countries, and then we started advertising. So we spent 50K, so 10K a month for 5 months, in about 100 countries on Google.
In each of 100 countries, you spent $10,000 a month for 5 months?
Yes, correct. Okay. So we spent $5 million total. And in some countries, but we weren't bidding for expensive keywords. We can't afford to compete against eBay Motors for cars for sale or BMW for sale. But no one's really bidding for BMW 325i Red Union Square for sale 2007. And so if you do long tail bidding on millions and millions of keywords, and literally we're buying 2-3 million keywords per country per language, like a penny a click, but tracking everything such that we were optimizing our customer acquisition costs on the back end per posting, per reply, per dollar of revenue. And in some countries, mostly through lack of competition, it took off. In many countries, it actually didn't work. So it didn't work at all in the U.S. It didn't work at all in any of the developed countries.
Except it didn't work in the U.S.
It did not work in any of the rich countries because, A, there were incumbent competitors, but, B, advertising is a lot more expensive. 50K doesn't grow really that far in the U.S. in marketing.
I see.
Same thing in France or Germany, et cetera. But in a few countries like Brazil, India, Portugal, and frankly across Latin America and Pakistan, it really took off. And so we started focusing and reinvesting in those countries until it really came down to two countries that we're clearly focusing on, which are Brazil and India.
Brazil and India. How do you get lock-in? If somebody comes in from Google, they see a web page, they say, oh, you know what? I thought I wanted this car, but it's not really the car I want. I'll go back to Google and I'll keep searching. They build loyalty to Google, not to you.
Because in the early days we were search driven, but ultimately the transaction happens on our site, not on Google. So the place where you actually reach out to the person, did the transaction, gave a rating or a comment to the seller, it's all us. And so if you have a great experience, you're going to come back to us directly. And by the way, if you have a problem in your transaction, who do you reach out to? Well, clearly not Google. They're not part of it. And ultimately, when we build a big enough company, we started to have enough revenues, we actually started building a brand. And so we're now doing TV advertising and brand building in India and Brazil. And we've run really funny and mass market TV ads across India and Brazil. And now we're a real brand there. And much more than half of our traffic now comes directly either to us or through Google by people typing our brands. And so then it's direct. It's not as though they find an item and they do back. And then there are tricks. Even if a user comes through SEO, and if it's not the item they want, we say, well, by the way, these other items might be what you're looking for. Or maybe this item was sold or is no longer relevant. But and so we give them opportunities to go back to our site instead of going back to Google. We give them opportunities to see related ads, to click on the next page, go to the search results. And so we try to convert them. And so there's an entire trick about converting visiting users from Google into real users.
You sold a chunk of the company in 2010 for how much?
August 3rd, 2010, the day of my birthday. So it's a complex deal because they bought out the VCs, they bought out the early investors, and then they bought out part of the management team, and they also invested a lot in the company. So depending on whether or not we include the investment, it's either $150 million or $250 million, but in that range,
okay.
And they bought like 70% of the company. But all that's public because the people who bought us.
So you got to take a little bit of money off the table.
Yes.
But you didn't have to. So why did you?
I didn't actually want to sell OLX. But first of all, we're competing with a very well-funded, publicly traded competitor based in Norway called Schibsted. And these guys were starting to attack our markets one by one. And we realized that actually to win and win in a big way is going to take a lot of capital. And so actually having someone willing to invest the hundreds of millions required to do it would be tremendously helpful. And then simultaneously, a lot of my management team had not made money before. And they came to me in 2010 and they were like, look, we've been working really hard for 5 years and we'd like to take some money off the table. And even though I could have said no, the reality is it's not my place to prevent others from living the opportunities and having the same opportunities for freedom that I got with Zingy. And I'm like, you know, I completely understand and I respect that. And even though I don't particularly care to sell, I'm going to support you in your endeavor. And so the top 10 employees, if you want, wanted some liquidity. And so I said, okay, let's do it.
And you went along with it for yourself also.
And well, because it makes sense, because once someone owns the majority of your company, you're not necessarily in charge of its destiny. And so if I had a stronger clarity or vision or ability to exit my shares in the future, I probably wouldn't have sold. But in light of the fact it wasn't quite clear how, once you're part of a bigger entity, what happens, I decided to sell the same percentage that every one other employee sold. So personally, it's a smaller exit than Zingy for me, even though the transaction value is much greater than Zingy's. And the company is much bigger than Zingy, not in revenues, but in usage, traffic, et cetera.
You then went on to invest in other entrepreneurs as an angel investor. How many investments have you made?
So I actually started angel investing in 05. I mean, so it's not as though I did it.
Post-OLX. I see. I thought this was after.
No, I'm still co-CEO of OLX and it's still my day job. The investment started immediately in 05 and I've invested now in 102 companies since I started angel investing.
Before we started the interview, I was talking to you about the investments you made and you told me about one person who, after I think it was a single conversation, you said, okay, I'm in. Who was that person and what did she say to you?
So before I answer the question directly, I mean, we've actually, over the years, I've made a lot of mistakes in angel investing. I mean, I started investing $6 million in six companies, burning $6 million in six companies, and completely changed the approach. And so now, I actually have a real method to the angel investing.
What was it? Can you talk a little bit about the mistake that you made? You invested an average of $1 million in each of six companies. What did you do wrong?
Well, you know, I suppose that success breeds hubris and arrogance. And I was convinced that because anything I was going to touch was going to turn into gold, because clearly Zingy had turned into gold. And so I invested a lot. I felt that if the teams were really good and the ideas felt good, and if I joined the board and became very active, it was going to help. And the reality is all six companies failed for reasons that were not – I mean, the teams were great. The products were great. And yet – in some cases, maybe a competitor came from a conjoint area, started offering the product for free, and there was no real intelligent way to pivot. I mean, so they failed for reasons beyond their control. And I realized how much luck there is, really, in the internet in general. And so I changed the approach fundamentally. Also, being on the board, I realized I was being an administrative overhead for them. I was imposing reporting, et cetera, but it wasn't value added. And so since then, I invest much smaller amounts. On average, I write 50K checks. I mean, they range 25 to 250K in many more companies because there's that luck element taken into consideration. And I've also defined, I only now invest in things I understand. So I only invest in consumer-facing companies, only in e-commerce travel marketplaces and user-generated content if it crosses into these, and either new innovative ideas in the US, and that's about 40% of the deals, or copies of established ideas, meaning 100 million in sales and profitable, in the rest of the world. And the rest of the world is really Russia, Brazil. Now, that being defined, because I don't have time, because it's my night job, let's say I get 30 deals a week. Of those, maybe 20 are out of the box. We don't even look at them. We don't even reply. 10 are in that specifically B2C box. 5 are interesting. We meet the 5. And then it's a 1-hour meeting. And based on, do we like the idea? Do we like the meaning? Do we like the business model, the market size, et cetera? Do we like the entrepreneur? Do we like the product? And we expect the product to be live. And do we like the deal terms? And the answer is yes. Essentially, we'll commit to the deal after 1 hour. But in that case, the company is called Quincy Apparel. Christina came in, and the founder, and she basically told me everything I wanted to hear. So most entrepreneurs don't come in understanding their unit economics, their customer acquisition costs, their distribution strategy, and she had basically thought it through all through ex ante, and she'd already garnered like 50K a month in sales. She had really high gross margins. She explained why she had those gross margins, where the distribution strategy was, how our competitors were like Ann Taylor, Banana Republic, et cetera, were hated by women. So Quincy Apparel sells a business attire on a private label basis to women. And so she had gone and done all these surveys at Harvard Business School and Columbia Business School. I mean, she basically had answers. She'd addressed all the major concerns. She was extraordinarily eloquent and clear in her vision. And it was just a no-brainer. It's like, okay, this makes perfect sense. Let's build a Warby Parker for business female apparel. And so I think 30 minutes in, I was like, okay, let's do it.
Let's see. There's one other one that I want to talk about, and then I want to get to what you did with to get yourself to break free of the social shyness. Where was that in my notes? The person who was a good salesperson, who was there it is, gave a guy funds to start a business who came out of jail in 2004. Now, this is through an organization that you support, not you directly, you were telling me.
Yeah, so my passion in general is entrepreneurship and promoting entrepreneurship. And so I like creating companies, which is my day job. I like investing in entrepreneurs, which is my night job. But I also give money to four NGOs that promote entrepreneurship, and they're either through micro loans or micro donations or microcredit, or through just assistance to entrepreneurs. And these organizations or Endeavor, which helps entrepreneurs in Africa and Latin America. Promujer, which does micro loans in Latin America. And that third one is Project Enterprise, which does micro loans in New York. And Project Enterprise, which is a company I've helped raise money for, they came and did a fundraiser in my apartment. I've given them money over the years. They do micro loans to young entrepreneurs or to entrepreneurs in New York. And so this guy came out of jail, born sales guy, but came up with a business plan to sell incense perfumes in the streets of New York. And he needed actually needed a loan, yeah, for about $1,000. He came to see us. He was very convincing. We gave him that loan, and little by little, he grew the business where he had that one table, that one license, to like 10 tables, several employees working for him, hundreds of thousands a year. So he came to us actually for a second loan to start
Selling,
getting
wait,
a.
selling. I've seen those guys who sell incense in the
Yeah,
streets of New York. I
and perfumes, yeah, and
just thought it was like one man operations. I thought it was.
for the most part, they are, and you need to be licensed. But in his case, he made it a 20-man operation,
Just those little
doing
folding
hundreds of
desks
thousands.
selling incense and
Yeah,
perfumes.
exactly.
Hundreds of thousands in revenue.
Yes,
What's his name? How do I get him to do a Mixergy interview?
I need to find his. I need, he has a complex name. It might be something like Abdul Jazim Akeem, but he's in some of my PowerPoints. I'll find you the contact information. But he's really cool, and so he actually came to us for another loan afterwards. So he could buy a van, so he could move the inventory from the tables that we're not selling to the tables that we're selling. You know, shift the mix, the product
Okay.
mix, etc. And he's continued to do well. But he's one of a few that have actually done well in that program.
That's one of the great things about entrepreneurship. And doesn't it bother you that our schools in the US and other countries will not teach entrepreneurship?
And I'm not sure if I actually didn't think this through. I think there are a lot of things you should do to fix your K through 12 education system, and actually make sure we have much better science education in general. Now, in terms of teaching entrepreneurship per se, I'd have to think through what the best way would be to do it at K through 12 or college. So I'm less clear on that one, but
You're
I
not
do
even
think
sure
there's a
that we
lot
should be
of it.
teaching this stuff.
I'm not sure. I think we should be encouraging people to be look. I think we should be encouraging people to be critical thinkers, to have great fundamental math skills. We should be pushing engineering because the OECD average is 12% of engineering degrees. The U.S. is at 6%, and China is like 20%. So we have a massive dearth of computer programmers and engineers, which is creating to that essentially zero unemployment level for engineers, which actually is bad because it's limiting or a lot of the companies that could be created that are not being created because from lack of computer programmers and engineers in general. But entrepreneurship per se, yeah, I think a lot of the skills in terms of oral and written communication skills, how to raise money, et cetera, can be taught. But I think we have to fix our fundamentals before we get to maybe more abstract things like that.
All right. We'll save that conversation for another day. But I will say this before I ask you about the final question. To everyone who's watching, you can see the schools are obviously not teaching education. But one place that is mixergypremium.com, where I bring on real entrepreneurs. I ask them to turn on their computer screens, ask them to take screenshots, I ask them to walk us through what they do so that you can follow along with them and learn from them. So if they do customer service really well, I ask them to turn on their screens and teach me how they answer customer service emails, how they process lots of emails, what they do to reduce the number of emails that come in before people even write them. If they do PR well, I ask them to teach that. Anything that they do well, I ask them to turn on their computer screens, take screenshots, whatever, and to teach us. It's all available to you at mixergypremium.com, and I hope you join. If you are a member, you get access to all of it. So go watch right now. All right, so Shyness, you're a guy who told us about how you talk to the carriers, which most people would be afraid to call. You talk to lawyers who sent you cease and desist letters, which most of us would be afraid to respond to. You talked to all of them and you still considered yourself shy?
Well, at that point, I was already undergoing, I'd gone the transformation from socially awkward and shy in the business world to being extroverted and confident in that environment. And I think it started happening at McKinsey because I get to McKinsey, and McKinsey hires really smart people, but the most successful people there were not necessarily the smartest. They actually the people that had emotional intelligence, the ability to work with the clients, especially those who are not necessarily nearly as smart as the consultants were. And realizing how effective and powerful it was to be extroverted, to actually be interacting with the clients, to understand their needs and concerns, and to ease those, and to be really listening and an active listener was extremely useful. And then, of course, as an entrepreneur, you're the public face of the company. You're talking to the press, you're talking to the employees, you're recruiting, you're raising money. And so, over the course of both deliberate practice in terms of forcing myself to take classes on public speaking to actually doing it, became rather confident and extroverted in my business life, but not at that point when I was, let's say, 25, 26, yet applied it in my personal life. So as confident and successful as I'd become, and I'd become that, I was not like that by default in my business life, I was still socially awkward, shy, introverted in my personal life. Massive fear of rejection from girls, very few friends because I'd not been social and didn't go out at all. And so I decided it was time to address that.
And what did you do?
So the first thing I need to do is address fear of rejection. And so the best way to do that is to get rejected. And it is a quintessentially entrepreneurial thing to do because as entrepreneurs, we beg and grovel for money. And in the process of begging, groveling for money, we're being rejected all the time by VCs, by angels, by friends. We try to recruit people, and a lot of them don't trust us with their future life and careers. And so and frankly, the process of like building a product is iterating. You just throw stuff at the wall until it sticks. So I decided that I was going to apply the very same mechanism to my personal life. And so for 100 days, I decided to ask 10 girls a day out in the streets of New York. I would just randomly walk up to a girl, and as a good economist, statistician, document, pickup line, use, location, et cetera, and just ask her to go out on a drink with me, for a drink with me that night. And in the course of that 100 days, I got rejected 955 times. But lo and behold, A, because of the law of large numbers, it was still like 45 days, which is a date every other night. And then that process is useful to understand how dating works in this country, in general, which I'd never gone through before. And at the same time, once you've been rejected 955 times, the 956th rejection doesn't hurt nearly as much. And so became much more confident about my ability to go up and talk to anyone about anything and the consequences of putting yourself out there and failing are actually de minimis. People forget, even if they judge you, who really cares? What impact does it really fundamentally have? And so it was extraordinarily liberating to realize that I could put myself out there. And I was, quacking in my boots. I mean, shaking, and I had, like these big nerdy glasses, and I was awkward, like to no end. And yet I survived, and that survival turned me into a much more confident, passionate extrovert, even in my personal life.
Why, I mean, what pickup line worked best?
The second most effective pickup line was when you're walking in the street in the same direction as a girl, or we're in the subway platform, et cetera, is, "Hi, as it seems that our lives are headed in the same direction, I felt compelled to introduce myself to you." If she smiled or laughed, I had an opening, we started talking. If not, and many of them would like just ignore me completely, walk away or whatever, then it didn't work. The single most successful pickup line was actually, "Hi, seem like a great person. I'd love to buy you a drink tonight." And so just direct approach, and those are the ones that most likely led to a yes.
Just straight up asking them out for a drink.
Exactly. Simplicity, directness work best.
So when you were in high school, you didn't get to date much. You were watching everyone else go out on dates, and you weren't out there at the prom or whatever the French equivalent of the prom is.
We don't have a prom in France, and I was like the uber nerd, the guy with the highest GPA in the school, who spent all of his free times programming, playing video games, studying, reading,
So how did that shape you that you were the uber nerd who wasn't getting a lot of dates?
You mean no dates and no
Who's getting
friends.
no dates?
Well, it definitely gave me the time to actually work really hard and accomplish what I needed to accomplish. I mean, even at Princeton, I mean, I didn't have any. I made one friend there. I didn't have dates there either. And part of the reason was I was so fantastically good at getting A pluses and so fantastically good at building my companies and at my jobs that, and I was so fantastically bad and awful and awkward at the rest.
So did you say to yourself, dating is not for me? Or did you say, I've got to do something so that I can earn the right to date or that I can be seen by women who will approach me and I won't be rejected?
No, neither. I actually didn't enter the consideration side. I was extraordinarily intellectually arrogant and condescending. It was more the rest of humanity is wasting their time. They're going dancing, listening to music, drinking, and socializing, whereas they could be doing something significantly more important, like learning new things and getting A pluses and getting ready for world conquest. And so I had actually no desire to socialize because I didn't feel like I related to the rest of humanity. And what's interesting is there are people like me at Princeton, but I had no idea where to find them. And so even though later I became really close friends to fellow nerd geeks from Princeton, I actually met them at McKinsey or elsewhere. And so I was really condescending and judgmental then. And then ultimately realized, you know, the rest of humanity seems to value these things called friendships and dating and sex and girls. So, you know, there might be something there. Let's be a little bit more humble here and let's see what the world has to teach me. And then I realized how little I really knew about the world and how people worked, etc.
When did you have can I ask you a question, a personal question that I have no right to ask you?
Go for it.
And I can't edit out the answer of? How old were you when you lost your virginity then?
27.
Wow. And so up until then, you just felt like this is for the rest of the world. It's not me? Or you didn't feel any sense of insecurity about that?
Yeah, I sent some insecurity, but yeah, I was so extraordinarily good at everything else. I'm like, yeah, who cares?
You don't have to be good at everything. What happened to 27? Who was she?
Very smart Oxford McKinsey girl who I hit it off really well with. But at that point, I'd gone through the 1,000 date exercise when I was 25. And so I was already starting to understand the rules and realized I actually didn't like any of those dates. I mean, the 45 dates. And so I started deciding to go after girls that I thought would be more likely to work for me and ultimately found one. And I started dating and, the rest is history.
What's the most meaningful relationship you've had since then?
Well, define meaningful in terms of, you mean longest? You mean
you define
the one that I felt? I'm not sure. I've met a number of people that I felt were. Well, actually, no. Let's take a step back. I've been in love twice, madly in love twice, okay. And I felt the potential for it a few times. For a number of variety of reasons, it didn't work out. Now, I actually ran a personal regression analysis on all the people I've dated to understand what were the variables that mattered most in terms of maximizing the potential of chemistry and love. And my current the statistically significant results came down to the three most important variables are intellectual chemistry, as in my perception of their intelligence, it may not be absolute measures, and people have different respect from that, physical attraction and sexual chemistry. And now that's what I look for in relationships because I suspect this is what maximizes, absolute chemistry. But at the end of the day, right, as Carrie Bradshaw said, it's all about the zazazu or the je ne sais quoi. So that's what I think we're all looking for.
I so love that you're willing to be open about this stuff. That you were always open about this stuff? About everything?
Yeah, reasonably. I mean, there's nothing – it is what it is. And there's nothing to be to be shy or bad. I mean, people can judge what they want to judge, but at the end of the day, it's the experiences I went through, and I'm actually grateful for the fact that I've been through them because I probably wouldn't be where I am today, and I've been through that exercise. And so, to the extent that I'm the result of the experiences that I've had, there's nothing to hide.
And it didn't shape you the way that it shaped me. I've talked about this in past interviews that because I didn't get to date much, I felt like I'm going to earn enough money that one day women will, that I'll figure this out. I'll have enough clothes. I'll be able to hire someone to dress me so women will be more attracted to me. I'll spend time figuring out how to have conversations with strangers, kind of like what you did with the 10 girls a day. But it was like my obsession that I needed to get to build a successful company so that I could get to this part of my life. I'm looking at you. You're making a face like I'm a crazy person.
Yeah,
nothing like that.
I didn't care. I wanted to conquer the world. I mean, you read my my diary when I was 14. It was like, be president of the ruler of the world by the age of 40. It was like, so it was like, I was looking at like Genghis Khan or Augustus or Octavian as the role models, not It,
Do you still
that
have
didn't
that? I
it
have a
didn't
little bit of
matter.
that too, and I've noticed that in past interviews. Do you still have it in yourself?
I feel extraordinarily ambitious now. So maybe to some extent, reality has interfered with those underlying ambitions. I mean, the political process is so disappointing and
Right.
broken and corrupting that it's not a path that I see for myself. And actually, I would argue that the best use of my time actually is being an entrepreneur, is for promoting entrepreneurship through either the NGOs or through investing in other entrepreneurs that are creating the future. I mean, at the end of the day, GDP per capita growth is driven by productivity growth, which is driven by entrepreneurship. And so we are the engine of growth. And the reason that the world that today is the way it is, meaning we don't actually, like 120 years ago, or die at the age of 40, working 100 hours a week, not being able to travel, vacation, or even ponder the meaning of life, is because of all the economic growth that was brought about by the technology revolution, the productivity revolution of the application of that technology. And so we are the engines of economic growth. And this is the very single best use I can make of my time. So even though I'm not ruler of the world and seemingly will not be, it's still a worthy and frankly fun aspiration and fun endeavor. Now in terms of the dating thing, I don't know. At the end of the day, like I'm being a tall, reasonably good-looking, successful entrepreneur, it's actually very easy to date and date a lot of people. I think at the end of the day, the reason I wasn't obsessed with it, and the reason I didn't care like being successful to date is the person I was looking for was never a just someone to date. It was like maybe someone who's going to be my partner and as an equal, an intellectual partner who's going to conquer the world with me and will push me to be the best I can be and vice versa.
And did one of the
And
two
so,
girls who you mentioned earlier fit that?
could have, or a number of the girls I've dated might have fit that, but it didn't work. But at the end of the day, I think I hope to find that whatever Harvard valedictorian supermodel who wants to conquer the world. I mean, these Venn diagrams don't intersect very much, but there must be someone out there.
All right, I'm sure there is actually. And who knows, maybe she's out in my audience.
Well, based on my experience in entrepreneurship, you probably have a 95%
Why
male
do you think that
audience.
is? Why do you think that there aren't a lot of women in entrepreneurship?
A number of reasons. I mean, first of all, I wish that I suspect that there are cultural factors in the sense that parents and teachers already skew women towards the liberal arts as opposed to computer science and engineering. And so there's a cultural bias to begin with. If we push more women to be mathematicians, engineers, et cetera, we'd already have more of a case for being entrepreneurs. Because today, entrepreneurship, at least as we define it, is driven by technology. Now, there are many female entrepreneurs or women entrepreneurs, but they're building bakeries, restaurants, et cetera. And so it's small business as opposed to entrepreneurship that scales. The second thing is, I suspect, I don't know, maybe we're not instilling at the educational level, like the right values in terms of like how much work it is. And you need to be willing to make the sacrifices and work 100 hours a week, 7 days a week. I mean, I worked literally 100 hours a week for 10 years.
You go
And
to bed now at 2 a.m.?
yeah, but I don't, but I stopped work at like 8
Oh, I
p.m.
see.
So
From 8 to 2
8
is
p.m. to
all
2,
hobbies.
it's all free time. Yeah, exactly. It's reading books, going to movies, playing tennis. I mean, writing my blog. It's not, I'm not working 100.
Helicopter skiing, from what I understand.
Yeah, not at those times. I mean, those I actually to go and do, or kite surfing or play tennis.
Who are those people, by the way, who are walking behind you? You're at the office now?
I'm at the office at OLX in New York with a whopping four people.
Okay.
We have finance and marketing in New York.
Right. Well, thank you so much for doing this interview. I hope I get to meet you in person. And I can't believe how open you
Likewise.
are, but I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And I'm going to say this to anyone who's watching. If you got anything out of this, first of all, check out his blog. And it's just FabriceGrinda.com. Of course, we will link to it. But second, do what I'm about to do. Say thank you. I've got to tell you, ever since I've been suggesting this to people, I've been CC'd on some emails. You guys don't need to CC me, but do connect, because I see the back and forth that happens in some cases, and it's more than worth just sending a quick note to say thank you. And I'm going to do it right now. Reese, thank you so much for doing this interview.
Oh, thank you. It was fun.
All right, and thank you so much for watching. Bye.